Welcome to this podcast of Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Greg Dalton, founder of Climate One. Climate One brings together thought leaders from around the world to advance solutions to global warming. The Commonwealth Club is a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. Join us online at commonwealthclub.org. Welcome to today's meeting of Climate One at the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Greg Dalton, the founder of Climate One. Today we're talking about the road to Copenhagen. The United Nations negotiations now underway are scheduled to conclude in Copenhagen in December with a successor to the Kyoto Protocol. Countries that sign a possible Copenhagen Treaty would then have 3 years to ratify the New Deal before the Kyoto Agreement expires in 2012. That's the idea, anyway, of climate negotiators and advocates. Is the world on track for a landmark deal that puts a price on carbon pollution for the first time? What are the keys to achieving a global compact among developed and developing countries? Will the U.S. pass domestic climate legislation? What will that agreement look like? What will the U.S. legislation look like? Joining us to discuss these questions are John Bryson, Chairman and CEO of Edison International, parent of Southern California Edison and one of the largest electric utilities in the U.S. He is also a co-founder of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Bill Riley is chair of ClimateWorks, a new initiative backed by philanthropic foundations. He's also a senior advisor to the Texas Pacific Group and former administrator of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency under President George H.W. Bush. Larry Schweiger is president of the National Wildlife Federation and vice chair of the board of Al Gore's Alliance for Climate Protection. He also is chair of the Green Group, which is a group of large environmental organizations in Washington, D.C. So please give a warm welcome to our panel today. Bill Riley, let's start with you. You encouraged the first President Bush to go to the Rio Summit in 1992. Could you set the stage for us as far as where we are on the road to Copenhagen? What's the basic framework? What deal's on the table there?
Well, I did encourage the first President Bush to go to Rio. You remind me that I didn't do that with that much enthusiasm, at least a few months before the conference, when there were the same kinds of uncertainties and incongruities in different countries' expectations, and frankly conflicting signals coming from the government of Brazil about whether they were prepared, even logistically, for the 14,000 press and all of the other people who descended on Rio. I received an invitation from Prince Charles about 6 months before that conference to join him in Belém and to sail up the Amazon for the better part of 3 days on the Britannia, and accepted that invitation, among other reasons, because the president of Brazil and the three key ministers, foreign minister, environment minister, and energy minister, were all going to be on board. And I was able to say to them, with the president there, you're giving so many conflicting signals about how this conference is to come off. You don't appear to be prepared, in our view, at this time to consummate a number of the relationships and agreements that we had anticipated would be on the table there. And I'm not going to recommend that the president come in the middle of a political campaign, particularly, unless we get some assurances. And I did get those assurances, and President Collor was as good as his word. He said, I promise to make this work for President Bush. 65 heads of state are awaiting his decision as to whether he comes. So it's vital to Brazil that he attend. And I say that because a lot of the same kinds of conflicting expectations and incongruous demands are being bruited about now, and we read about them in the press, different countries dissatisfied with the lack of interest or pusillanimous commitments that appear thus far to be under consideration in the negotiations. And would simply say that a lot can come together. There are many reasons why some people will find it in their interest to elevate expectations for the conference and others to begin to dumb them down a little bit. And you will see both happening in the months to come. The really important thing is that, in my experience at least, most of the substantive agreements that are reached at international conferences of any significance are baked substantially before the meeting begins. If they are not, then people will find a way, certainly in a conference of this public recognition and significance, to make it a success anyway. and to have Copenhagen 2, which will then be understood to have a cleanup responsibility. I think personally that it's extremely important, obviously it's extremely important that Copenhagen be a success and be seen to be a success, and I believe that it will be. What is being baked right now is very important. The United States administration is committed now to address the climate problem in a serious way. That has enormous consequences for the attitudes of many other countries, and most notably for China. The patience with the Obama administration, I think, will be considerable in Copenhagen, even though, as I expect, we do not have completed, enacted statutory commitments to a carbon tax or to carbon reductions by that time. The Chinese are very unhappy with the legislation, we understand, that has come out of the Waxman-Markey conversations, and they wish to see a 40% reduction from 1990 levels in part of the United States, which is certainly not in the cards. But these are early negotiating positions, I think. Once we do have some reasonably clear path in the United States, I believe that the Chinese, who now are speaking of climate change as a challenge which must be addressed, they were not willing to do that up until relatively recently. They talked about the need for more energy efficiency in their economy, but they considered the climate responsibility largely that of the countries that had committed to the accumulated carbon dioxide. That is very promising. And the Germans, of course, have committed to at least a 20% reduction in carbon dioxide. They are the greenest of the large powers, a 30% reduction if they think the agreement that comes out of Copenhagen is serious. European Union has already committed to 20% and has said publicly that they will commit to that reduction irrespective of what the rest of the world does. That is both good and bad. I think they've kind of lost a little bit of their negotiating leverage as a result, but they're greener and certainly more publicly green than many other countries. And you have other positions. The Japanese are simply waiting to find out what they should do and prepared, apparently, to do something very significant, though on a purely voluntary basis. They do not want mandatory constraints in law on their economy, which is an interesting position. However, voluntary in Japan means that Kyoto Gas and Electric and Tokyo Electric will do what the voluntary commitment of the government of Japan is, unlike in our country where business would go the other way and has. So I gather Singapore wants a tax, thinks there's no way that you could set up a congruent cap and trade system internationally. In other words, there's a lot that's still being baked. But I think it's extremely positive that the focus of countries is now seriously on the climate issue, particularly given all the other distractions that they have in the current economic situation, that when they get there, the weight of the world's expectations and attentions will itself have influence on the negotiators. And if not at the conference specifically in Copenhagen, then in Copenhagen too, we will get something that I think can cause us to breathe a little more easily, that this problem is being given or will soon be given the attention that the number one threat to the planet deserves.
Before we hear from Larry Schweiger, I'd like to follow up and just ask whether you think that the basic architecture of a big all-in-one global deal is the way to go compared to some different bilateral or sectoral agreements that might be, you know, different pieces that add up to a whole. Are you still think that the sort of the all-in-one, the granddaddy treaty is viable and preferred?
You know, I honestly think the original concept of the global deal, which was going to be agreements and substantial transfers of funding and technology to the developing countries in return for their taking the climate problem seriously, I don't think that's still on the table. I was asked at a conference in India some weeks ago whether the United States was prepared to play according to those rules, and said, well, I guess it really depends on China and Japan whether they'll give us the money that we then can give back to India. And, you know, we're no longer in that position. And I don't think politically that's in the cards. Some kind of offset program, some kind of exchange that occurs as a consequence of the business interest of companies in the United States and the developed countries essentially buying reductions as a competitive kind of choice, an economically intelligent decision given the price of carbon, I think that's still very much in the cards. So I think that probably will happen. Whatever else happens in Copenhagen, I don't think there should be a deal that precludes the possibility of important bilateral relationships and even some sectoral commitments so that you don't get in the position of the laggard swinging the whole train. And I think people are sensitive to that, and I don't think that will happen.
Thank you. Larry Schweiger, you're in Washington and very involved with U.S. domestic legislation. Tell us your take on the Waxman-Markey bill. How far does it go? Where is it strong and where is it weak? And how does it relate to? Generally, people think the U.S. needs to have a strong legislation to go to Copenhagen in a strong position.
Well, I think it's important to start with what we need to do in Copenhagen. And, our, you know, the long-term goal is to keep our planet from going, not warming over 2 degrees centigrade. So if we're thinking in those terms, you're talking about 350 to 450 parts per million. You know, some would suggest it needs to be lower. Some would suggest that we can go higher. But that's generally the range that we're aiming at. So when you think about how we're proceeding domestically, you know, I think it's fair to say that it's going to be hard for us in the first go-around to get to even to a 450 world with a bill that is moving through Congress now. But that bill is the beginning point, not the end point for climate strategies. I think Bill mentioned coming back again at Copenhagen 2. Congress right now is not willing or able to do what science requires us to do. So what we have is in both Congressman Waxman, Congressman Markey, Speaker Pelosi, and so many other people of goodwill are trying to get to the first step. And this bill has a lot of important pieces in it for that first step. There are some 32 embedded tools in the bill itself that have different aspects of getting to that goal. The most important probably of those is the cap itself, which is set at about a 17% reduction over the next 10 years. Certainly, there are those of us who would like to see that higher. I'm sure there are others in the business world who would like to see it lower. And the chances are that we'll probably be able to hold it at 17% in the House. There is, in addition to that, a number of other ways in which we save and reduce carbon emissions by efficiencies in appliances. There's a whole new set of building standards that are going to come into play. There's also the offsetting, and that will get us an additional percentage or two internationally if it is set up correctly and works well. So, you know, is it a perfect bill? No, but it's the bill that we can get through Congress. And I should say something about the sponsors, about Congressman Waxman and Congressman Markey. They are two very committed lawmakers who've been around the Hill for many, many years, who know how to navigate the system. Frankly, they've put together the best bill that they can get. They're working very hard to make sure that they get moderate Democrats to the table, because we only had one Republican. Mary Bono Mack was the only Republican to vote for that bill in the House committee. We're hoping that we pick up more House Republicans in the full House vote. But clearly, they had to craft a bill that worked for the moderate Democrats. They had to craft a bill that addressed the cost of carbon to the consumers, and so there are mechanisms in the bill to help consumers in that process. And there's also funding in that bill to help wildlife and other natural resources for adaptation purposes. There's about $1.7 billion a year that will be available over the life of the program. So there are a number of really important elements that are in place. I think it's an important first step. I think we need to press forward in the House and in the Senate. Hopefully soon we'll be able to take up a similar bill.
Do you think the Senate will strengthen or weaken the bill?
Well, it depends what you're looking at. I think there may be some pieces in the bill that could get strengthened in the Senate. There are also some pieces that may get weakened. It's still unclear. We do have some experience in the Senate. For example, last year we had the bill that moved to the floor of the Senate.
Warner Lieberman.
The Warner Lieberman. Before that, we had McCain Lieberman bill move, but neither one of those bills took away the power of EPA to do the things that EPA currently has the power to do. So there's a chance of addressing that in the Senate to get that back in, because certainly I don't think we want to remove any powers from EPA to enforce the existing clean air laws, particularly as it relates to carbon. So I think there are some places in the Senate where we can make improvements. And don't forget, we have the final conference committee that hammers out the differences, and there may be some improvements there as well. But I think it's important for all of us to, you know, not let the perfect get ahead of good here. This is a good bill. It's a good foundation. It will enable us to go to Copenhagen in a respectful way and to present to the world a pathway that perhaps can lead to additional commitments from others. And I think also there's a provision in the current bill to allow scientists to look back, to actually see how we're doing and match that up to the goals of the Copenhagen Agreement, so that we know one way or the other from a scientific standpoint whether we're making the right kind of progress, and if not, to send off some clear signals to the Congress that we need to tighten up, and to the rest of the world that we need to move more swiftly.
So it's not perfect, but it's a start. Let's talk a little bit about, drill into the money aspect, because a lot of the fights is about you know, where the economic burden hits and where the money goes, both within the United States. Can you talk a little bit about that? And then I'd like to get to Bill and talk about internationally between countries, you know, how the money's going to flow, because that's a big part of this is ultimately people say in countries, yeah, this is great, we want to do it, but what's it going to cost me, my country, my company, myself? So
the estimate for the average consumer is that it'll cost about a postage stamp a day, is the pricing if you look at it from EPA, which is not a whole lot. Postage stamps are going up, but not that much. Some of the mechanisms in the bill that are this so-called allocation issue, and that is for some people very controversial. There are folks in our community who would like to just simply make a tax, collect this money, and then redistribute it to everybody in the country in an even sort of way. The problem with that is if you're living in Indiana, you know, about 90%+ of your total electric bill is produced by coal, and so you're a high carbon consumer. If you're in another state, perhaps Oregon or Washington, where you have a lot of your energy being generated by run-of-the-river turbines, you have a very different situation. So it's not fair just to collect the carbon tax and redistribute it in an even way. And that's the reason why the early proposals to do that were not well-received in Congress. There are too many members who have concerns about that kind of distribution. But 80% of the total revenue collected under this program will go to public purpose. Another 20% will go to help, for example, the steel industry make the transition, to help some of the other industries involved make that transition. So it is, if you look at the way the money is being spent, it actually advances the overall cause in a way that helps us to solve the problem.
Now, critics would say that a lot of votes have been bought in coal states, that the auctions, both President Obama and Governor Schwarzenegger wanted to have 100% of these permits auctioned off. Now I think it's 15 or 20%, and that basically critics say on both the left and the right that Congress bought votes from conservative Democrats in coal states. And, of course, that's what, you know, that's the way things work. But, you know, could you comment on that?
I think there are two ways to look at it. One, it starts off low, but it grows year by year, and so the auction will actually become 100% at a future point. So, the notion that we're given money early on is problematic to some people. In terms of buying folks off, I'd rather characterize it getting to the vote. You know, the magic of this thing is if you can't get the votes to pass the bill, it doesn't matter how pure and how white, you know, clean the bill is in every way. It matters that you can get the votes to pass it. And so you have to work with people to solve problems that they see. And I actually think Congressman Waxman did that. I think that he went across to the Blue Dog Democrats, to members like Congressman Doyle, and sat down and said, what do we need to solve your problems? And what they needed was to help some of the industries, the heavy industries that needed to get through the next few years. And I think that was a part of that process. And if you have problems with that, you probably shouldn't be involved in the legislative process, because that's the nature of this. It's like watching sausages, has pointed out in the past. But, you know, it's really, that is the messy part of it, but it's an important part. And I think Waxman is very good at getting the best deal for the American public. And I think that's what we have.
I would just add, if I might, to that, he had better get some of the coal state senators one way or the other. There are more than 50 of them.
Yeah.
So, right. and an equivalent number percentage in the House. So that's vitally important. With respect to allocation, it is an issue, and now there's some proposals. I saw an op-ed yesterday from three energy executives who want to increase it more, reduce the auction even more, and that's got a number of my friends upset about it. You know, we did the Clean Air Act the first time, fully allocated, no auction. If you look at the situation of a coal-fired power company in the state you mentioned, Indiana, with an auction, they've got, first of all, to figure out how to reduce their carbon cost by converting to natural gas or finding a way to scrub, or rather to sequester the carbon. And then they've also got to pay for the permits. I mean, it really would be a big hit. And, of course, Senator Bayh is not going to vote for that. And neither are a lot of other senators whom we really do need. So from an environmentalist point of view, I wouldn't break my pick on the allocation versus auction issue or number. I think that the Waxman-Markey bill produced a plausible, realistic, reasonably prudent approach to this, and it deserves in some areas some improvement, but I think is a very credible bill.
John Bryson, you've done a lot of work on thinking about the least cost path to reducing carbon. We're talking here about the money flow. So what do you see as the important ingredients of getting to carbon reductions at the lowest possible path?
And, could you say how you like BART?
Yeah.
I like BART.
And your carbon.
I like Southwest Airlines a lot, but Southwest Airlines didn't do as well as it normally does today.
Yeah, thanks.
Least cost path. Well, let me just start by saying that this is a uniquely global challenge, climate change. And unless we find least cost paths to carry out greenhouse gas reduction, transform our economies, we simply will be less successful in the critical job of reducing these greenhouse gas emissions. So least cost is kind of a paradigm thought here. What is the least cost? You know, I'll start with a huge generality. The Waxman bill, most careful thinkers about what the U.S. needs to do here, envision a 2050 target that is a reduction on the order of 85%, it may be 83%, it may be 80%, but a reduction across our total economy, U.S. economy, of that order of magnitude, so almost total carbon reduction in the economy. And almost all observers, close observers, believe that carbon at current levels will continue to grow over the next several years, even with the best energy efficiency technology and so on steps. So we have to think hard about what can be done in the first 10 years, the first decade through 2020. And that is substantially working with the current least cost tools and investing at the same time in the kind of transforming steps that will begin to take each year a larger reduction prospectively through 2020. And what we need to do in the first 10 years, and I'll be brief on this, and I regret I don't know what already has been covered, is fundamentally three things globally. One, hugely important, forestry and agriculture steps. So that's about something less than 50%. 46% by the work of the Global McKinsey Institute, by the work of Project Catalyst that Bill's very close to. We've got to do that, and that will require a huge financing. And one of the key things in thinking about all this financing means from developed to developing countries. And we get then into what's called offsets. I won't try to describe those as a possible means of getting that job done, but it's a least cost path. And then the second thing, and definitely the least cost U.S. step, developing country step, and least cost all around the world, but not having quite the same potential in this first decade, technically, as the forestry steps that could be taken, and that's energy efficiency. And California set the highest standards across the country in that respect, quite notable, but yet more can be done in California. Lots more can be done across the country. And then the last step, the one that in some ways gets the most attention and is incredibly important, and that is we push forth with clean energy sources, renewables, and so on. But in the first decade, those technology steps will have less impact than they need to have in the out years. So that's a very brief summary.
You mentioned offsets, and we have a question from the audience about recent reports noted that offsets in the bill before Congress will impede real reductions overall. And offsets, maybe we should try to define what they are, because they're a big part of both the reductions and also the money flow. Would anyone like to go deeper on offsets?
Let me respond. I was a part of the U.S. CAP group, not in the final report, but working through the process that's currently in the bill. The offsets are a mechanism for finding this least cost that John was talking about. It's really important, you know, the best thing you can do for consumers is to reduce the carbon in the cheapest way possible, and one of those tools is to be using the additionality in forest to reduce carbon by growing crops, for example, on lands that actually help store carbon in the soil, to put the black back in soils, as I'd like to describe it. Our soils are healthier when we have more carbon in them, so it's a multi-benefited approach because it actually stores more nutrients. It also prevents the runoff of water. It keeps soil temperatures lower. It does a whole bunch of things that are very important. So that's a really good investment, and it's one of the early off investments that you can make. And then there's this opportunity that we have to go out and actually find other reductions and help one another. And that's really hunting down the lowest carbon reductions. So if a company needs that carbon and another company is willing to share their reductions, they can find a way to make that work, which I think is a very important part of the tool. And then finally, you can go into the auction pool and buy the allocation if you want to. So there's multiple ways of covering your bases, but they all lead up at the end of the day to real carbon reductions, either through carbon capture and storage, through new energy techniques, or through the storage of carbon in soils and in forest.
I'd be happy to say just a brief word about offsets at a kind of more basic level, because I want to underscore they're an opportunity and a challenge. Offsets are part of a cap-and-trade program, so across the U.S., across Europe, the most likely federal legislation involves cap-and-trade as opposed to simply taxing or setting carbon prices. There are political reasons for that. There may be some other good reasons, debatable point. But in any event, in a cap-and-trade program, to emit a ton, for example, of greenhouse gas emissions, it will be required that there be a credit for the ton released. And some of the least cost means of reducing carbon will be outside the United States, outside the developed countries. And so for those, there can be developed a system to have offset credits so that the release of the greenhouse gas in the United States is offset by a credit that has a certain value to be applied under the U.S. system. But what's really hard to do is set valid offset processes. So it's quite a complicated thing. It's important to do it. It's hard to do well, and we could spend the remainder of the time on the subject. I won't go further, but we shouldn't fail to try to do that.
John Bryson is former chairman and CEO of Southern California Edison. We're discussing climate change at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. Our other guests are Larry Schweiger, president of the National Wildlife Federation, and Bill Riley, chairman of Climate Works. We have a couple of questions here about something that often doesn't come into this conversation, and that is population. One question here, wouldn't it be help if each nation were limited to one child? Not sure how viable that is. Every 10 years, it says. There's another one here. So you could have three children over per family. Another question here about John mentioned food, agriculture, efficiency, renewables, asking the panel what you think about population as it relates to increases in CO2 emissions. So let's... No takers. Larry, step up.
Let me say that it's not just... The population is obviously important, and we need to assisting particularly other nations that are growing rapidly to stabilize through some supports in that direction. We can't dictate, you know, family sizes. We can't dictate behavior, and we shouldn't try to do that. But on the other side of it, we need to understand that our footprint is so much larger than the footprint of other nations, and so it's not directly correlated just to population. It has to do with how much carbon people are emitting. So they're really, you know, there are two problems. They overlap each other, but they're not completely congruent. And so solving one isn't necessarily solving the other. What we need to do is reduce our carbon emissions worldwide, and we need to focus on the most efficient steps for accomplishing that. And also, while we do that, encouraging other nations to address their population challenges.
Anyone else on population?
The only thing I would say is I think going back to the World Bank report, I think in 1988 or 89, it's very clear the single most effective thing you can do for so many purposes, but certainly for population limitation as well, is to educate the young girls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That raises an interesting question, because that issue is not often part of the energy climate debate, clearly. Although I think when Senator Clinton became Secretary of State, she wanted to make some changes in USAID and try to get a more holistic view. So let's move on here. You know, there's some questions here about, we've been talking about economics. What sort of moral dimension is there to this? Clearly, all of you have talked to people in developing countries. They say, look, the U.S. and industrialized nations created this problem. You have an obligation to do most to solve it. Is that going to hold any sway in Copenhagen, or is it all going to be about hard dollars and cents?
I think myself, the degree to which that has influence will affect, it does affect a great many other countries who are waiting to get the signal from the United States, whether we as the number one emitter historically, no, not apparently now, but historically, are willing to accept the responsibilities incumbent upon that fact, on that history. And to the degree that we do accept it, the 20% of emissions for which we're responsible will then, I think, begin to have influence on the 80% that we don't control. So I think it is actually a hugely significant reality that President Obama has fundamentally recognized, and the Congress looks like it's on a path eventually to recognize. That will make a great deal of difference. I personally am reluctant to turn too many environmental issues into black and white moral questions, because I think if you do that, you make the kind of compromises that are inevitably going to be part of the democratic process and the international negotiations much more difficult. People lock into very rigid positions. And also, when you go to developing countries, and I've spent a lot of time in them, and you see a country, for example, like India, which has more than 500 million people without access to latrines, there's more than a reason of distraction that they're not paying attention to climate. They have a lot of other much more immediately pressing problems. And climate, as I was reminded in Rio a long time ago by 5 ministers, no one was dying in the streets from biodiversity or upper atmospheric ozone depletion or climate change, the major issues from the point of view of the developed countries. So I think one has to keep that in perspective. There are many moral reasons to attend to international development issues. The climate fundamentally can work, certainly control of carbon, to improve the lives of people worldwide in so many ways. And I would keep that out in front of us, that it's not merely something nice to do, but we're going to have a world that is much less habitable and congenial if we don't address the climate problem. I wouldn't myself overdo the characterization of moral obligations and how to sort them out.
Bill Riley's a former advisor to President George W. Bush on the environment. Bill Bryson, did you
George
want to?
George H.W. Bush.
George H.W. Bush. Forget the H. Is there a difference?
Yeah.
John Bryson, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I'll be very brief on the point. I agree that it doesn't usually help to frame things in moral terms because they tend to get rigidified. But, you know, many of us feel that there is something of an ethical responsibility here. Even if expressed, however, in utterly pragmatic terms, a reality is that we in the developed nations, we in the richer societies, simply as a pragmatic matter, are going to have to make substantial commitments, not just within our own economies, but around the world, to lead in this change and to help finance and support it in other places around the world, or it won't happen. And almost to a unique degree, the climate challenge is a no man is an island phenomenon. We're all in this together. Yeah. So should we in the richer countries with the greater technology capacity and the greater financing capacity fail to do a substantial part of what has to be done around the world helping others, we simply lose. We get hurt.
Mm-hmm. You spent time as a utility regulator and running a utility that focused on very sharply on cents per hour, kilowatt cents per hour. Can you envision a situation where a company says, look, we need to pay ratepayers or citizens need to pay a penny per kilowatt hour because we need to generate some revenue to address the kinds of things that you just talked about, the economic burden, the economic responsibility?
Well, the short answer in some ways is absolutely yes. What California has done, and it's done it for a long time with the investor-owned utilities, is knowingly incur higher cent per kilowatt hour costs. This is true for three decades, substantially higher than the U.S. average, in order to invest in the kind of systems we have in California. So we have the highest level of renewables in the country. We have more investment in smart grid than is done elsewhere. We have much higher investments on the part of the utilities in energy conservation programs in which the utilities incentivize, subsidize. At Southern California Edison, we have 99 separate programs, very expensive. And those contribute to higher cent per kilowatt hour unit costs because you're not spreading then the infrastructure base across as large a set of sales. So California has done that. So, you know, the question, there can be a question about just how high those costs can go, but the reality is California is higher and knowingly higher. That's been part of the regulatory environment for the investor-owned utilities for as long as I've been close to it.
Larry, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I was going to comment on the moral obligation. I tend to agree that perhaps it doesn't work well in a negotiating setting, but I do think that we all need to search our hearts and think about what we're doing individually and societally to address this problem, because if you think about it, we're almost locked into perhaps as much as a 3-foot rise in sea level. Well, if you do the math, there's 100 million people who live within 3 feet of sea level. And so there are a lot of folks who are living
in the United States.
In the world.
In the world, okay.
Yeah, there's 100 million people in the world living within that zone. I recently spoke at a global conference for mega deltas and the scientists who are working on mega deltas. Well, if you know anything about deltas, they're all, you know, low-lying landscapes, and they're very fertile. They produce a lot of food for this world. And most of those mega deltas are going to be underwater in the next 50 years. So we have a moral dimension to this that we need to confront. And I must say there's another part of it for me personally. I have two grandsons, and I have a third on the way. And I worry, frankly, about what their world's going to look like as a result of what we're doing. So I think it's important for us to examine ourselves and think about what we're doing and how we're acting and what we're doing to advance the solution from a moral frame. But I would agree with the others that perhaps, you know, trying to do that in a international negotiation is probably not the right place to start. So I think on a personal level, we all need to examine our lives.
Larry Schweiger is president of the National Wildlife Federation. Another question from our audience at the Commonwealth Club. Substantial progress to avoid climate change may reduce, require changes in lifestyle, gradually improve what we do. So how is this going to impact economic growth? Generally, you know, how much is this going to cost or hurt? Or is there opportunity in this transition we need to make?
I believe that that there is opportunity. You know, I wouldn't underestimate the cost, particularly in the early years of adapting the economy. I think we're going to see something like $20 a ton of carbon, and we're big carbon generators and users in the country, and those who continue in that pattern without making the adjustments or the investments are likely to be impacted by that. And I just this afternoon looked at some costs that one electric utility is expecting as a consequence of those numbers, and they're considerable, and ratepayers will, of course, be confronted by them, and that's one of the things that has to happen. But one consequence of that is you will create incentives for investments in cleaner fuels, and I think you will first see a run to natural gas in this country. I think we'll very heavily start to see more natural gas used to supply electrical energy. You will also begin to make profitable and give a trajectory that is relatively straightforward and predictable, and is not the start and stop kind of thing that we've had when in the past, when according to gasoline prices and electricity prices or natural gas and oil prices, we all of a sudden get a downturn in those prices and everybody abandons investments in solar and wind, which has happened to us. I think there's much less likelihood of that happening once we get a signal, even if it's a disappointingly small signal relative to what you and I might like. Once the signal is there and the trajectory is relatively clear that that is where the country and that is where the world is going to go, you are likely to see, I think, a flourishing, a renaissance of interest and investment in new technologies that are cleaner, that are less carbon. And it turns out there are plenty of them around. And then you're also going to see people do the kinds of things that make sense for themselves economically anyway. The cost curves that have been done by McKinsey show that there are so many things, particularly the United States, can do that we have not done, some of which other countries, like Germany, have done before now with respect to insulation and all of the rest, that will allow us to look forward to a much less expensive future and certainly much less wasteful future with respect to all sorts of things that we now have.
You mentioned clean tech. I'd like to mention breakthroughs. John, if you have a first thought, then...
Go ahead. Or you move along.
Go ahead, if you'd like to jump in on that.
I think that that it makes sense each in our own lives to be more conservative than we have been. But I guess I just caution on the larger point, the global point, that a huge challenge here is the reality that the developing countries, and particularly the largest developing countries of the world, China, India, we know these things, have what seem to me legitimate aspirations to bring the levels of prosperity in their own countries to the levels that exist in the developed world. So an appeal simply to being more thrifty and more conserving and living less affluent lives is unlikely to be a very successful mantra or theme, it seems to me, in meeting the global challenge here. So it seems to me that what we've got to do, as I indicated just in my first comment, is we've got to do as much as we can in the next decade with the tools we've got. But I, for example, have spent a lot of time at Caltech. I happen to live near Caltech in Southern California, and met last week with seven teams of faculty members who are doing work, faculty members, postdocs, graduate students, doing work on fundamental basic research and applied research, physics, chemistry, a whole series of things, looking to the possibility of transforming breakthroughs of the sort that without sacrificing the capacity of people in the less developed and particularly the least affluent countries in the world could be by plentiful means at low cost approaches that some decades out would make a difference. So it's not going to be, in my judgment, by 2020. I can imagine it by 2030. And it seems to me we ought all, those of us who care so much about this, ought to be big supporters of enhanced basic research and applied transforming research across the country. Then find means to scale it up.
What are some examples of big breakthroughs that would be game changers on the technology horizon?
Well, I can just describe, no one knows what the transforming technology will be. That's the most important thing to say. I would love to see 10 Caltechs in the country with a lot of dollar capacity. But I'll describe one at Caltech that just is, to me, exciting. This is a group of people, 7 grants, quite a large number of graduate students, the best in the country. They're not better than MIT, but in that vein, I mean, we're talking about the very best that we have, and they're not all of them U.S. citizens. They're working together to develop a photosynthesis process that is entirely synthetic. And the principles here are relatively easy to grasp. Earth-abundant materials, so that we don't put ourselves in a position where the materials on which we're relying, as with some of the current solar technologies, become scarce, so those aren't driven up high in cost. Simple means of taking to scale once created, to capture as close as we can what is the holy grail here, and that is finding a means of converting efficiently sunlight. I mean, the amount of sunlight that falls on the Earth in a matter of hours in a single day is sufficient to serve the entire world's electricity needs. I mean, we're not going to get to that level of efficiency, but if we could do these breakthroughs, it's not impossible that we would see opportunities to have a fundamentally different energy system at scale a long ways out. Now, we should take no actions today that assume anything other than modest evolution from the carbon-intensive infrastructure we have today, because we have to be conservative, take steps now against what we have. But we ought to be investing for the future that way.
We have a question from the audience about carbon sequestration. Do you think that is possible? Do you think it's a fantasy? Do you think we should pursue it? How aggressively?
Well, I'd be happy to talk briefly about that. Our company was working with British Petroleum on such a project. I'll try to give the short version and take it further. You know, there's a fair amount of experience across the world in particularly in oil companies, in using carbon dioxide and injecting it for enhanced oil recovery. So there's that experience. There's a lot of experience our company did too, one in Italy, one in California, demonstration projects of gasification of coal to create synthetic fuels for driving electricity. But I think the sequestration point is the toughest one. And when, again, you ask the question at scale, it's one thing to do this for some time frames for carbon, not sequestration, but to enhance oil recovery. There are a limited number of geologic sites that make that practical. So increasingly, there's been looking at, people have looked at deep seawater storage of carbon over time. There are formidable environmental issues associated with that. There are environmental associated with deep geologic storage. I'm a believer that we ought to be investing again in looking at this, but it would be way, way too early, I think, to be extremely hopeful. The reason I'm a believer we ought to invest in this is coal is simply an enormously plentiful energy supply, and not just in the U.S., but China. We know China's building the coal plants, more efficient than the current ones, mostly in the U.S., at the rate of about one a week at 1,000 megawatt a week scale. I mean, it's just hard to imagine. India has plentiful coal supplies. Russia has plentiful coal supplies. Indonesia has them. So coal's going to go forward. Coal's going to go forward. So we ought to be investing in means potentially of using that as a fuel with low or zero carbon content. But I don't think we ought to count on that.
Bill Riley, thoughts on coal?
I think John said it very well. The only thing I would have said is that there is a real need for significant investment in the technology to see whether we can make it work. It works very well, as you said, for enhanced oil recovery. I think the price per ton of CO2 sequestered by one of the oil companies in the North Sea is $10 a ton. It's estimated to be around $300 a ton for the oil sands in Canada. Trickier problem, more difficult geology. The possibility of sequestration in algae is something that I first was told about a year ago and carried around a proposal for a while and didn't even read it because it seemed so preposterously unrealistic to me. I'm told by engineers in the energy industry that, in fact, it's not at all, that this could be a very promising technology. I guess my point is that because of the point that you acknowledge about the abundance of coal and the inevitability that it will be used by the Chinese, the Indians, the Australians, the Indonesians, and Americans, we simply have to solve this problem. We have to find a way to make coal usable and consistent with our health and our climate. And I would be I would hope that the, what is it, $15 billion that's proposed now for sequestration demonstrations and experimentation, I would hope that that does begin to address this problem sometime in the relatively near future. And one number I have seen, maybe too optimistic, is 2020.
We're discussing the road to the United Nations climate change negotiations in Copenhagen. Our guests at the Commonwealth Club are Bill Riley, chairman of the Climate Works Foundation, Larry Schweiger, president of the National Wildlife Federation, and John Bryson, retired chair of Southern California Edison and Edison International. I'm Greg Dalton. A couple of questions here. Let's have these to Larry Schweiger. How do we reconcile the difference between the U.S. Congress, what the U.S. Congress will pass, and what the science tells us we need to stay below 2 degrees? Another one, our nation's top climate scientist, Dr. James Hansen of NASA, published a paper last year stating that we must reduce CO2 to 350 parts per million. What additional information and political pressure will be required to convince the countries to adopt this target?
Yeah, Larry.
how are you going to do that, Larry?
Let's start with the numbers. At 350 parts per million, we have between a 0% and 30% chance of staying below a 2 degree rise in temperature. So Dr. Hansen targeted 350 to keep it, in that range. So even his number is probably high. I'm actually a 281 guy myself, but the challenge with that is that. The challenge that we have is getting the science to align with the politics is really getting the American public to understand the urgency of this issue. You know, the American public understands we have a problem, but we're not breaking through with the latest in science. For example, Dr. Katie Walter and others have been studying the thermal karst lakes in Siberia and are seeing that methane is now leaking at 5 times the rate the IPCC suggested it would be leaking at this point in time. The Canadian boreal forests are now in such decline that they are net producers of carbon, not net sequesters of carbon. For the last 3 of the last 4 years and 9 of the next 10 years, they're going to be giving off more carbon in those systems than they've been storing. And as you warm up the North Country, looking out about 900 miles from the North Pole, you see that the rapid increase in temperature that we've already experienced there, and it's like unplugging your refrigerator and allowing things to start decomposing, and we're seeing that process begin in earnest, and it's outpacing, again, the worst science. So we have a problem, and it's a serious one, but until the lawmakers from across this country hear from their citizens and their voters demanding the kind of actions, we're simply not going to be able to pass the kind of goals that we need to get this job further along. But what we can't do, and I would urge us, and those of us who are deeply passionate about this, I would urge us not to throw out this bill because it's not good enough. Because, in fact, we need to get started. We need to move the process forward. We need to get the infrastructure in place. There's a lot of complications to this whole trading mechanism, to measuring how much carbon we have in agricultural soils and forest and putting all these elements together. It's going to take us a long time to get that hammered out. So let's get the basic framework in place, and let's get our scientists to come back to us with better advice on the kind of numbers that we need to achieve. I would say, based on the modeling that I've looked at, that we need to get about a 5% reduction per year in order to avoid that 2 degree rise in temperature. But that's work that we, you know, we can do better as we start down the road. You know, it's like a car. It's easier to turn the wheel when the car is actually moving than when it's sitting still. And right now our car is sitting still. It's not moving forward. So I think we take that first step with this legislation. We continue to educate the American public about the threats that are before us, and we continue to work around the world to bring a clear understanding of our challenge. And working together, I truly believe that we can win this thing. We can still turn it around, but we need to work together in ways that we've never worked before, and that includes Republicans and Democrats. I'm so pleased to be on the stage with Bill Riley because he reminds me of the days when we had great Republican leadership doing really good work. And my hat is off to you, Bill, for your leadership and in those years. And I hope we can get back there. We have both Republicans and Democrats working together.
Which leads to another question from the audience. Senator Inhofe has stated that the Republican strategy is to delay the Waxman-Markey bill, the American Clean Energy and Security Act, until we have a new president. Can we overcome that opposition? And I believe that the former governor, George Allen, former governor of Virginia, formed a new group just this last week that's aimed at affordable electricity and fighting, putting a price on carbon. So let's talk about, Larry, you're inside the Beltway. Let's talk about
They're both good friends of yours, I think.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah. What are you going to do about that?
Well, I think the Republicans that are acting the way they're acting are making a huge mistake because they're outside of the pale of science. They're outside of the pale of public opinion. And, in fact, I would suggest if you look at the numbers, it's a wedge issue. The Democrats should really be going after the Republicans because there are enough Republicans in all the polls to actually make a majority who want to see action on climate. And, for example, we're working with the Christian Coalition of America, and they've polled their members, and their members want to see action. So I'm not sure who these folks are really dancing for, but they're not dancing for the American public that we've polled. And I think it's a huge mistake politically as well as a huge mistake morally.
There was a time, you know, in the early phases, not just the early phases, of our environmental rally in America when so many of the major pieces of legislation were passed that we now revere, when there were bipartisan approaches to the enactment of these bills, and when the Republican contribution was largely to try to keep the focus on science. That typically was the angle of attack against some of those bills, and it was sometimes warranted. But science, we could all agree, should determine the direction that public policy and the environment and natural resources should go. At a time when we have had 11 National Academies of Science opine on this problem and say that there is a human contribution to the climate change and a significant one, when we have so much reinforcing scientific information now, and not just computer models, which in my time was all we had, we have observations now in Alaska and in Canada and so many of the other places, as you mentioned. It seems to me increasingly untenable to maintain the position that the science isn't there, these are natural phenomena, they're cyclical, and human activities are not contributing to them. So I don't know how long that position can be held. I suspect until the first natural calamity that people are able to associate somewhat with climate change. It has struck me, as I've been a member of the governor's Blue Ribbon Task Force on the Future of the Delta, and I'm kind of amazed, and I myself had to learn in the course of serving on that task force for 2 years, that we expect a 3 to 5 foot sea level rise in the Delta, which will cause some 1,100 miles of levees to be inundated.
By when?
In this century, yeah. with recognizable impacts within the lifetimes of most of the people here in this room. Why has that received so little attention by the leadership of the state, or so little action to address it? That's very close to home. That's very near term. That's something we can all look out the window and see. It is a bit of a mystery that obviously there are many things on people's minds, but one thing I really hope the president, with his enormous capacity to communicate, will take on is an amplification of the message of science and the future of the country and the world if we don't address the problem.
John Bryson?
I can't help but tell a brief story. This is on the Republicans and the Democrats and the Republican contribution. I have a good Democrat. I should lead that with that. But when a group of us, a bunch of young guys, when I was hair was darker than it is now, were setting up the Natural Resources Defense Council, we ran into a big obstacle. We couldn't get the 501c3 necessary tax exemption. And it was just a bunch of, you know, the Ford Foundation had surprisingly given us a little money. And this was during the Nixon administration, and this was denied to us. And there were a lot of comparable groups that had already received these exemptions, but we'd been a little controversial in the newspapers and other places. And the guy that made the difference, was a congressman less well-known at the time, a senior congressman, Gerald Ford. Mm-hmm. Jerry Ford, who'd gone to Yale Law School, where us, the group of us had gone, stepped up, and he implored President Nixon and the then head of the Internal Revenue Service to grant the 501c3 to us, and that was the launching of NRDC, and he was the kingmaker. He mm-hmm. made the difference.
Right. Good story.
An NRDC the Republican Party has long been proud of.
You indirectly mentioned another Republican, which is Governor Schwarzenegger. What do you think he or the California should do to keep the United States moving toward Copenhagen in an assertive way? Bill, what would you like to see?
Well, I think the governor has given us good leadership on these issues. I think his and it's important in talking about Republicans to recognize that he is notable as a Senator McCain, who's a consistent leader on the climate issue in the Senate for many years now, and others, Senator Warner. But I think that the example that California has set, which John Bryson referred to, of efficiency relative to the averages of electricity use in other states, is itself something that is useful to remind people in the rest of the country of. It is possible, and the ninth largest economy in the world has been moving ahead of much of the rest of the country to use its electrical energy more efficiently. The low-carbon fuel standard that the governor has proposed is definitely a step in the right direction, and he notably got support from a wide variety of groups, including ConocoPhillips Corporation, for the development of that standard. I think some of the research that has been encouraged in this state is vital to cellulosic ethanol, for example, and to clean fuels being developed. And then we have, of course, the Pavley bill, which the state is working very hard to try to understand, implement, and make congruent and consistent with the national approach to the issue, which is very important. All of these things put California on a path that can make us proud, I think.
We have about 2 minutes left. John Bryson.
Governor Schwarzenegger has really been a leader, so he deserves credit, and he's done things that I think no person otherwise in his position could do. And he succeeded a Democrat who didn't do any of those things, so he deserves credit. I want to say one other thing, and that is maybe it's already been said, but, you know, we ought to take great pride in our state mm-hmm. for just one fundamental statistics. Across clean energy, we've garbled our budget, we've garbled a bunch of things, but one thing we've gotten right is this. So, you know, since the late 1970s, California has had zero growth in per capita energy mm-hmm. consumption, when the rest of the country, on average, has had 40% growth. And perhaps that hasn't happened accidentally. That's happened for some of the reasons we talked about, which, among other things, went to the price acceptance of a slightly higher price of electricity per kilowatt hour than is accepted elsewhere. You know, it's a more complicated subject than that, but there have been didn't happen 5 years ago, didn't happen 10 years ago. It's been true since the oil price spikes of the 1970s.
If Peter Darby were here, he'd point out that the kilowatt hours are higher in California, but the actual bills are lower because of some of the conservation mm-hmm. appliance and that sort of thing.
It's true for residential customers. Of course, it's not true for industrial users of electricity.
We're at the end of our time here. I'd like to have one last question from the audience and have each of you respond briefly. If you were President Obama, what would you direct your climate negotiator to say to the Chinese on three or more points regarding Copenhagen? And let's leave it there. So,
you know, I thought a lot about that and talked to a number of people, one of whom was the former Secretary of State, James Baker. And I think he's gone public with his view that in an op-ed in the Financial Times, that the proper approach is for the United States to move to design a system which we are prepared to enact and implement, but not enact and implement it until we have gone to China and shown it to the Chinese and said, are you prepared to make comparable commitments consistent with your own stage of development and allowing for your own opportunity to grow and develop? That is one approach. And I'm not sure, frankly, whether it would be as effective as an approach which acts and recognizes the contribution of the United States, which has been disproportionate to the creation of the problem, prepares to address it in the United States with our own legislation, accepting possibly in the short term a competitive disadvantage with the country and its economy and its businesses, its corporations, its manufacturers, who don't have the same obligations, but essentially invites China to acknowledge the responsibilities that go with its emerging great power status. And there are people I respect who believe that that might be as effective or even more. And it's consistent with the kinds of questions that the Chinese have been asking many of what is a respectable position that we can bring to Copenhagen. That I would leave it to the audience to think, and those who know China better than I do. I've been going there for about 10 years with the China Sustainable Energy Program of the Energy Foundation. And I am actually somewhat enamored of that latter position. On the other hand, I have been co-chair of the National Commission on Energy Policy, and our business representatives, business members, were adamant that they would not themselves commit, and they didn't, in fact, commit to an open-ended agreement to support climate legislation in the United States without, in 2015 or so, having a look back, a review, a periodic assessment of whether, in fact, over that period, one of our principal competitors, which is China, had done something comparably significant and did not exploit the opportunity to have this competitive advantage. So I'm aware that of various views on this, but I think the game is going to be decided, I think, to a large extent before Copenhagen and after by what the United States and China can do together. And I have hopes that with the major efficiency improvements and commitments to them, 20% improvement in efficiency that China has made over the last few years, they are headed in the right direction. They're going to have automobile fuel efficiency standards that are significantly ahead of ours. Even in 2015, they're going to be at 42, we're at 36. So there are reasons to be optimistic and hopeful about China, and I am.
Larry Schreiger, really briefly.
Briefly, I would say that the bilateral negotiations between U.S. and China today are really critical. We ought to be paying close attention to that. Collectively, the two nations represent about 40% of the total carbon emissions. So if we can find a path forward with China, we can spread it to the other 18 countries that represent about 80% of the total emissions. And I think that's the way we build the deal out. I think it's important for us to work with China.
John Bryson, last word.
Well, I'm cautiously encouraged by the steps that the Chinese have been taking in the last two or three years, in particular in fields like electric transportation, which is extraordinarily important in its impact on greenhouse gas emissions worldwide, and battery development, which is related. They see economic opportunities to lead around the world with clean energy technologies. So they increasingly are using mandates to advance the things they care about. I believe there's a growing sense that their standing in the world, which they care about, depends on their being partners in this exercise.
Mm-hmm. We've been discussing the United Nations negotiations on climate change in Copenhagen. Our guests have been John Bryson, retired chairman and CEO of Edison International, Larry Schweiger, president of the National Wildlife Federation, and Bill Riley, chairman of ClimateWorks. I'm Greg Dalton, founder of Climate One at the Commonwealth Club, and now this meeting is adjourned.
guys.